Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, to begin with, he's one of the few realist novels that France has today. You know, French literature, you know, a turn with the new novel in the 50s and 60s, it became hyper-conscious about the act of writing. Writers still produce the same kind of sentimental tales of people going off for summer vacation and having an affair at the beach and coming back and it changing their lives, maybe a little, maybe not. You know, the novels are as dull as French movies generally are today. And here comes someone who offers this hyper-real, and by hyper-real, I mean as if you're living under Klieg lights and every pimple and every scar on the French body becomes evident. And because he has no competitors in that kind of realism, people have been really taken with him. Also, is offering, you know, the picture of the way the French live now. And so there's been an abandonment of this kind of writing in the French literary establishment, which not only has allowed him to develop this reputation, which is entirely deserved, but also to perhaps skew the French view of their own present.
Reactionaries are not conservatives. That's the first thing to understand about them. His story begins with a happy, well-ordered state where people know their place in harmony and submit to tradition and to God. Then alien ideas promoted by intellectuals, writers, journalists, professors challenge this harmony and the will to maintain order weakens at the top. The portrayal of elites is the linchpin of every reactionary story. A false consciousness soon descends on the society as a whole as it willingly, even joyfully, heads for destruction. Only those who have the preserved memories of the old ways see what is happening. Today, political Islamists, European nationalists, and the American right tell their ideological children essentially the same tale. The reactionary mind is a shipwrecked mind. The militancy of his nostalgia is what makes the reactionary a distinctly modern figure. The unsettling and judicious words of American writer, journalist, and scholar Mark Lilla from his latest book, The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction, published by the New York Review of Books. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Do we all suffer from a bit of political nostalgia? And why do some political leaders have an apocalyptic view of contemporary life? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with Mark Lilla, Professor of Humanities at Columbia University and the author of The Stillborn God, Religion, Politics and the Modern West and The Reckless Mind, Intellectuals in Modern Politics. This is a show about the origins of populism, the history of ideas and the politics of nostalgia.
My name is Mark Lilla. I'm a writer and professor in New York City. I was trained in the history of ideas and have devoted most of my academic career to studying the modern Enlightenment and especially its critics. When I put my other hat on, I'm a liberal journalist here in the United States and write quite frequently for the New York Review of Books and for the New York Times on contemporary politics. In the past year or so, these two jobs have somehow come together since the rise of the populism of Donald Trump. And lately, I've been trying to put the new populism, both in the United States and in Europe, into the context of a longer tradition of reactionary thought. And that is what ended up inspiring me to write my most recent book, The Shipwreck.
What a fascinating book, The Shipwrecked Mind, Mark. It's not only hugely engaging, but it's also very challenging, and it's so relevant to where we're going today. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with. Do you think political nostalgia is a form of self-deception? And within all of that, do you think political nostalgia has a sort of a psychological grip over us?
Yes, nostalgia is actually a quite fascinating psychological phenomenon, which I've studied a bit, and the history even of the term. It's only in the 17th century that the term nostalgia was concocted by a Swiss physician who was interested in understanding why particularly Swiss soldiers who were fighting in various wars in Europe as mercenaries suddenly became incapable of fighting, were very depressed, and needed to be sent back home. And it was the first time that this condition was really sort of medicalized and studied by the scholars of the day, and that continues up until the present. It turns out this nostalgia is a very complicated psychological condition to fall into. It is not only a yearning for what's been lost or a yearning for home. It's also a sort of springboard, you might say, for thinking about the future. So nostalgia is a kind of trap. I mean, it's, as I think you're suggesting in your question, that we're always thinking about the present and the future in terms of what happened in the past. And we can borrow from the past, we can learn from the past, we can argue about what actually happened in the past. But something happens to certain minds where they're so dissatisfied or feel so lost, especially lost, I think, in the present, that they go looking around for something to hold on to. And what they hold on to is an image of the past that is cleaned up, that doesn't have any complexity or contradictions, and they get an idea fixed in their heads that somehow we've fallen from some original golden state into the present. And once that takes place, the mind then finds itself in a sort of vicious cycle, so that the more it idealizes the past, the more unbearable the present seems, and the more unbearable the present seems, the more there's a tendency to idealize the past even more. And so this can be seen as a psychological condition of individuals who fall into this, thinking about, you know, the old homeland. Immigrants have done that, certainly in the United States. I mean, there's still Irish bars where they're singing Danny Boy all the time. And but it's also a political condition. A nostalgic mood can really grip the whole of a society. And we're beginning to see, once again, how powerful it can be as a psychological motivation.
So were you aiming the book at Le Pen in France and the likes of Donald Trump in America? Were you?
Well, actually, I was. My thinking began really about the Weimar years in Germany. And so the book begins with three thinkers in the German-speaking world, two from Germany, Jewish, and one from Austria, Catholic, and their reaction to the First World War and especially the collapse of liberal democracy in the Weimar years and the rise of fascism. And two of them in particular came up with complicated, really elaborate theories of history in order to make sense of the present. And then I was putting some of these essays together. I was living in Paris, and there were the terrorist attacks on the magazine Charlie Hebdo in 2015, and also a kosher supermarket just outside of Paris. And suddenly, you know, I'm faced a couple blocks from where I'm working in my office with this scene of these young men who have this view, this idealized view of the Muslim past and of the rule of Sharia that they want to reimpose. And so suddenly this kind of nostalgic reaction is very contemporary and in my face. And then there was the French reaction to all of that, and there were a lot of writers on the French right who then went off in their own direction, idealizing France before there were immigrants, before there was Islam, before colonialism, and a yearning to return to that world. So suddenly I was faced with two very contemporary forms of political nostalgia, and I thought I was just going to write about ones that examples that were from a much earlier time. And so that's really when the book came together.
You write, if time is a river, then it's like the Nile Delta, with hundreds of tributaries branching out in every imaginable direction. The trouble starts when rulers or ruling parties think they can anticipate where history is already headed.
Yeah, well, I use the metaphor of the Nile Delta because, you know, the Nile comes down and then it immediately goes into all these little streams and rivulets and tributaries. And that's what it's like, in fact, traveling through political history, that at every juncture, you know, the river is taking you so far and that story is over. But in front of you, there are always places to turn in one direction or another. And if you turn in one direction, that opens other options further along down the line. If you turn in the other, those other options are foreclosed and others opened up. And so we're always sort of navigating a kind of delta of options politically. And there are all sorts of outcomes that are potential when we start flowing down this river. And where we end up depends on the decisions that we make along the way. And that's what it's like, I think, to be realistic and frankly mature about history and about how political life relates to it. But the nostalgic, like the political nostalgic, like the revolutionary, doesn't see history that way. They both see, both the reactionary and the revolutionary, see history as this one river that's flowing, and then there's a sudden break. And at a certain moment, the course of the river changed, and nothing was the same again. For the revolutionary, either that revolution has happened, and now they have to fight to accomplish the revolution, or they're coming up to the point where this turn is going to happen and they're going to make it happen, and after which everything's going to be fine. The reactionary, on the other hand, believes that this radical break has already happened, and he quite literally has been shipwrecked, that the society that he was a part of, this boat going down the river, was shipwrecked, and it's been destroyed, and nothing but darkness follows. And so what that leads to is, to begin with, a search for those who are responsible for this break. So it's not as if we happen to go down one tributary or another, but rather that we were chugging along perfectly fine until something happened. And so there have to be agents of this destruction, and they can tend to be professional politicians, intellectuals, journalists, Jews, and then there's a group, or immigrants, you might say today, and these people get blamed for the destruction of the society. So the nostalgic person feels himself paralyzed and has to decide what to do.
I'm just wondering, do you think political leaders are adept at understanding the psychology of foreign nations?
Well, I think it depends on what country you're talking about. I mean, countries that have a colonial past are ordinarily fairly good in understanding what's going on in those countries because they have some experience there. And so the French have intelligent things to say about North African politics. They understand a lot of the dynamics. Britain, the same with South Asia. The United States is an example of a country that finds it very, very hard to put itself, its leaders do, put themselves in the shoes of people in other nations and from other cultures for a couple of reasons. One is because they believe the United States was this virgin nation that was born out of just the will of the people, and that any nation can reproduce our history, and we're bringing a universal message. On the other hand, we also have a tremendous experience with immigrants and assimilating immigrants. And so we tend to think that, well, if we can do that, other countries can do that as well, and that everyone basically, given a chance, would want to come to America and become an American. And so we're especially bad at being able to imagine the mindset of people elsewhere, and that's a very dangerous thing in a superpower. And so, we're really hamstrung here, I think, in trying to understand what the sources of these sorts of nostalgic reactions are elsewhere in the world.
You profiled three very interesting thinkers, Mark. Franz Rosenzweig, have I pronounced his name correctly? Rosenzweig? Erich Vogelin and Leo Strauss. What do you think Leo Strauss offered the world? He's a pretty well-known guy, had a very high-profile academic career, wrote some interesting books. I'm just wondering, how relevant are his ideas to how we're living today?
Well, there are really two legacies of Leo Strauss. One legacy arose out of his writings and his teaching. The other arose out of what his students did with his ideas in the United States. Strauss was born in a small German town. He grew up wanting to raise rabbits and just read Plato. He fell in love with Plato at an early age. He also got a rather orthodox Jewish education. And when he went to the university, he was studying philosophy. He studied for a little bit with Heidegger and with a number of other people, Karl Jaspers, and was going to have a just rather conventional career in Germany. And then with the rise of Hitler, he happened to be in England on a scholarship and was able to escape and came to the United States. And the experience of seeing the rise of Hitler and the collapse of Weimar, for him, raised these profound questions about the real foundations of political order, not just modern liberal order, but political order as such. And he set off on the kind of lifelong journey to try to put together and then tell the history of Western political thought from the ancient Greeks to the present into a kind of meaningful narrative. And the kind of story he told was that there were sort of two dispensations in the history of Western thought. The first was what he called the ancients, by which he meant not only the Greeks and Romans, but even medieval Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim thought, took seriously the notion of natural right, that there are human beings have a nature and there are certain things that are naturally right, not because we decide to say so, but because they are. And then he sees a break with that in the modern period, beginning with thinkers like Machiavelli and Hobbes, and then starts to explain a lot of contemporary political problems in terms of this break. But so that's the story he was aiming to tell. But along the way, he simply just was an extraordinary reader of philosophy and had a capacity to get to the heart of these books in a way that was, in a sense, not academic at all. And he was a wonderful teacher, and his seminars are now online at the University of Chicago. One can go online and listen to his seminars, and they're quite extraordinary performances, very modest, humorous, really trying to get to the heart of each book on its own. And so he was just, quite extraordinary man and an extraordinary mind. So that's one legacy. The other legacy is what his American students did with his teaching. He was a Weimar Jew, and he had experiences in Europe and had a certain culture. His students, on the other hand, were young American kids, a lot of them Jewish, a lot of them brought up in families where they were supposed to assimilate, and here they discovered this vibrant Jewish thinker who was quite proud to be a Jew and to study Jewish things as well. And so they became his students. And then what happened is that they all got jobs in American universities, and then the 60s happened. And suddenly they see riots on campus. A number of them were teaching at Cornell University. Black students were running around with guns, shooting things up. And they thought two and two together and thought that, in fact, what was happening to American democracy is what happened to Weimar. And this was the end of America. And they became apocalyptic. And they then became very nostalgic for an America before the 60s. And so they ended up, the American students, being quite reactionary in a way that Strauss was too abstract to be. And these neoconservatives ended up having a huge impact not only on the American Academy, but on American political thinking and political action more generally.
And of course, in the White House. I found Franz Rosenzweig's story particularly touching and also hugely impressive. He was from a German Jewish family, born in 1886, and he endured an unbelievably crippling degenerative illness. But he produced so much different types of work. And one of the aspects of his thinking that I found particularly interesting was that he believed the battle against history in the 19th century became for us the battle for religion in the 20th century. Can you explain all of that to me?
Right. Rosenzweig, a lot like Strauss, he was a little older than Strauss. They knew each other. He, grew up, lived just before and just after World War One. But unlike Strauss, his background was not Orthodox Jewish, but he grew up in a very assimilated home. And at a certain point, he was about to become a professor of philosophy. He had written a major book on Hegel. And he was convinced by one of his cousins that he ought to go all the way and just convert to Protestantism. And he made this decision and then decided to go to Yom Kippur services for the last time in the synagogue. And he went, and when he returned home, he told his mother, "I made my decision. I'm going to remain a Jew." But for him, that meant not being an Orthodox Jew. Rosenzweig knew that the reason German Judaism had become so weak in the 19th century is that there was a development of what was called liberal Judaism throughout the 19th century, which was also part of this movement of liberal religion that was also very strong within German Protestantism. And my book before this one, called The Stillborn God, is the story of the rise and fall of this liberal religion movement in the 19th century. And the notion was that for the major thinkers in these movements, that religions needed to be modernized. They needed to be stripped of naive belief in miracles, things that were obviously nonsensical, needed to be more tolerant, more rational. And that by doing historical research into the roots of these religions, one could come up with a more modern faith that would be compatible with the modern lives people were living. So the idea was to sort of, to use an archaeological term, re-Christianize, to clean up and restore these religious faiths by trimming away all of the accretions of the past, and to tell a good liberal story, so that the lesson of Judaism would be to be a good liberal modern person, the same with liberal Protestantism. And so in Rosenzweig's view, history came to replace revelation, that because history has brought us to a certain place, we need to adapt the religion to what history has done. And he was not happy about what had happened in modern history and the kind of society it had produced, and also that the whole transcendental dimension of human life was being denied in these movements. So he thought it was false to try to go back to a life of the Orthodox. He couldn't imagine himself going back to a shtetl and living a life that would be totally inauthentic for him, someone who had grown up in a modern world. So instead, he tried to reimagine what a new Judaism would look like that would return to the power of revelation, but make no compromise with liberal modernity, that would stand for the transcendental and putting the contemporary life in terms of the divine and what lasts. And so he developed a very, it must be said, idiosyncratic view of what this Judaism would look like. He wrote a very obscure book called The Star of Redemption, where he laid all this out. But more practically, what he did is he set up Jewish teaching schools throughout Germany, where young Jews who had never really gotten a Jewish education would go, and they would start studying the Bible. They would study Talmud. They would study the great Jewish sages of the past. And Leo Strauss was involved in both studying there and in the teaching in these places. Martin Buber came out of this movement. And so it was an effort to kind of have Judaism be reborn rather than in the future, but rather than moving back to the past.
He certainly was a very original thinker. But I'm just wondering, The Star of Redemption, when this was published, I think it was around 1901 or around that time. And then we have Hitler within 30 to 40 years. And now look at the new Jewish nation and look at Israel. I'm just wondering what he would make, how would he would make sense of what has happened in history.
Yeah, well, he left some obscure and contradictory statements because, as you noted, he got sick with a degenerative nerve disease. It's called Lou Gehrig's disease in the U.S. And so couldn't speak much. And as his collaborator, Martin Buber, became involved in the Zionist movement, he made some contradictory statements about it. I think he worried that Zionism was not at all going to be tied to Judaism, but rather was going to be simply a way of ending Judaism as we know it and becoming just a kind of socialist state, and that those who were inspired to go to Israel and to found a state were in fact looking to escape their Judaism and instead build a kind of utopian society there. On the other hand, he also saw that the willingness to be assertive about one's being a Jew as being a very healthy reaction, that rather than hiding or pretend changing your name or having Christmas trees or whatever it was that your neighbors think that you weren't Jewish, that these people assumed their Judaism. They took it on, and the fact that they were Jewish. And so that self-assertion is something that he applauded and that he himself cultivated in himself and in his students.
The Shipwrecked Mind, Mark, develops on the idea of cultural pessimism. And I think you write that it's as old as human culture and has a long history in Europe. I'm just wondering, within all of that, do you think we have a very negative view collectively, that we have a very negative view of modernity and where things are going?
Well, I think we're divided right now. I think actually at this present moment, I think we want to avoid the question more than anything that, during the Weimar years, the interwar period, parties of left and right had given up on what modernity had produced because of the war, because of the Depression, violent revolutionary movements, assassinations. There was a sense that somehow we had taken a terribly bad turn. After World War II, there was euphoria about not only the triumph over fascism, but the success of our modern economies, liberalization of laws, building of the welfare state. But now I think there are the contradictory feelings. On the one hand, a desire on the left, and especially the left of the left, to continue pushing to modernize our societies in ways that people in these groups think of as being modern. So questions of identity and tearing down taboos that we have about various things, the way we raise our children, sexuality, and the rest. And those who think that modernity is still an unfinished project and think of it as a project. On the other hand, we have all this disquiet, both on the left and the right, about the world we're living in now. So, there's disquiet about the modern global economy and the inability to control it, especially in Europe, given the construction of the European Union, that progressives on the left and reactionaries on the right are both, literally up in arms about now. And so people, I think, want to be selective about what parts of modernity they want, right? And so those on the left want a kind of libertarian society when it comes to cultural questions, but they want a non-liberal modern economy, something that's much more controlled. And some people on the right want the reverse, or some of them want to return to an earlier past both in the way we handle our economies and the consequences, and culturally. So there does seem to be an abandonment of the liberal center. That's what I find most striking, especially over the past 6 months, what we've seen happen both in Europe and the United States. It's sort of an abandonment and a forgetfulness.
Yeah, you're right, Mark, that modern man became a kind of a Prometheus, believing himself a god capable of transforming anything and everything at will. It's a frightening thought, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think actually that's more, I think that what I meant by that was that's the reactionary picture of modernity, that the reactionaries, their explanation for the reactionaries on the right of how we've gotten to where we are now is that we abandon religion, we abandon our national traditions, we abandon our nations. We thought that we could remake everything from the bottom up, that nothing is natural, everything can be remade. And that's the picture of the modern age that reactionaries since the French Revolution have wanted to peddle. But in fact, the liberal tradition has not been about that, beginning with, I mean, the American founders. You have Tocqueville and Benjamin Constant. You have John Stuart Mill. I mean, throughout Europe and in the United States, you had this tradition that was very modern, that believed that certain things were natural and fixed and other things we could change. But we're also skeptical of large claims for religious truth, large claims for the capacity, the ability of a revolution to really transform human nature and human society. And so for me, liberal modernity is deeply skeptical, both about the claims of the past and dreams about the future. And it's that kind of liberalism that seems to be overshadowed in our present moment.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with American political scientist, journalist and historian of ideas, Mark Lilla, and attempting to make sense of everything from Trump, Brexit to militant Islam. So how do we understand the relationship between history and religion and the nature of political reactionaries? Well, in The Shipwreck Mind, Mark writes a lot about our collective obsession with different national myths and questions, why do people still feel the need for such myths? For the same reason people always have. We want the comfort, however cold, of thinking that we understand the present while at the same time escaping full responsibility for the future. I asked Mark about two of France's most controversial contemporary writers, novelist Michel Houellebecq and journalist and writer Eric Zemmour, whose 2014 book La Suicide Française was a runaway success. I put it to Mark, why focus on these particular writers?
Well, I focused on these two writers as examples of a certain kind of reaction to the new Europe of with massive immigration, with economic problems, with the construction of the European Union and the flight from the nation state as an institution. And these are all things to worry about, and they're both very insightful writers. Zemmour is a journalist, and he began sort of as a gadfly writing for various newspapers. It was hard to place him politically, really. He was always critical of whoever happened to be in power, rather humorous, very well read. But over the past 8 years or so, especially as long as, especially the last 5 years when Hollande has been in power, he's turned radically to the right and sees Islam as a threat to everything in Western civilization, Muslims as incapable of assimilation, and sees French elites as traitors to France, and therefore has become a very rabid populist calling for, you know, really a replacement to the whole political order. And, you know, encouraging people to rise up. So even though he won't put it that way, he has become a kind of master thinker for the National Front and for people even to the right of them. And, you know, what we were talking about earlier, the need for reactionaries to look for people to blame for the change in history. Well, Zemmour has found that in the elites who have allowed this immigration and refused to force assimilation. Well, Beck is another matter. Well, Beck's a novelist. And beginning with his first novel, which is called his first famous novel, Elementary Particles, he has been concerned about the atomization of our societies and the disintegration of traditional bonds of family and traditional sexual relations, marriage, male-female relationships, the rise in importance of profit and entrepreneurship. And he conveys in his novels a picture of the way we live now that's really bone-chilling. There's a kind of hyper-realism to his writing that really sheds a new light on the way that we live, and which is why he's become France's most important writer, without a doubt. But in his last novel, Submission, he really made a more reactionary turn. The novel is about a relatively young man who is unhappy as a professor in the university. He doesn't have any relationships with women that last. He's no longer in touch with his parents. He lives alone on sort of TV dinners every night. And what happens is that fighting breaks out between Muslims and people on the reactionary right. Elections are called, and a Muslim candidate becomes president of France. And the novel ends up being about him slowly moving to become a Muslim and converting in the end, partially because he's attracted to this traditional life and partially because he has no other reason to live anymore. And it's about the exhaustion of the West and its inability to offer an alternative to the thick, rich, traditional societies that are on offer both in Islam and in Judaism and in more traditional societies. And so his political nostalgia really came out in this last novel.
You argue, Mark, that Houellebecq has created a new genre, the dystopian conversion tale. I'm just wondering, what does that say about the state or maybe evolution of French literature?
Well, yeah, it says a lot. I mean, to begin with, he's one of the few realist novels that France has today. You know, French literature, you know, a turn with the new novel in the 50s and 60s, it became hyper-conscious about the act of writing. Writers still produce the same kind of sentimental tales of people going off for summer vacation and having an affair at the beach and coming back and it changing their lives, maybe a little, maybe not. You know, the novels are as dull as French movies generally are today. And here comes someone who offers this hyper-real, and by hyper-real, I mean as if you're living under Klieg lights and every pimple and every scar on the French body becomes evident. And because he has no competitors in that kind of realism, people have been really taken with him. Also is offering, you know, the picture of the way the French live now. And so there's been an abandonment of this kind of writing in the French literary establishment, which not only has allowed him to develop this reputation, which is entirely deserved, but also to perhaps skew the French view of their own present.
So, Mark, from writing The Shipwrecked Mind, I'm just wondering, how do you make sense of this historical moment we're living through? You've profiled so many extraordinary French and German writers and thinkers. So how do you reason with it all?
Well, if by that you mean you know, the rise of populism in
exactly.
the United States and in Europe, I think you can see some of the consequences of the kind of thinking that is characteristic of the thinkers I've written about. Not that they themselves have influenced current events, really, but rather that what I enjoy about and find fruitful in writing profiles of thinkers is that you not only study their ideas, you end up studying in relation to their lives, their psychology. And so you can see what role certain ideas even played in their lives. And you put yourself in the mind of someone who applies certain categories or, you know, flips on certain lenses for looking at the world. And the kind of despair about the present, the search for a recovery of something in the past, that's characteristic of the thinkers that I write about, one is now seeing in a kind of popular form that psychology becoming quite powerful as a force in contemporary politics, whether it's from you know, the Tea Party and the Trump phenomenon here, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the National Front, all these things are on the right, or whether it's on the left, you have Podemos on the left, a nostalgic for, you know, a pre-neoliberal economy. You have the five-star movement in Italy. You have the movement in Greece. And everywhere you look, people are just feeling, one has a sense that they're feeling dislodged, that they don't know where they are. There's a sense of being, you know, as the French say, dépaysé, as if you're no longer in your country. Where am I? And it's in moments like that, when people feel that they're, you know, there are no longer any signposts and they're in an unfamiliar place, that they're most likely, both as individuals and as societies, to fall into nostalgia. That I'm far that the problem with the present is not just that it's a problem; it's that I'm far away from home and I need to go home.
One final question for you, Mark. If history teaches us political, cultural, social, psychological lessons, whatever word you want to throw at it, what can we comfort ourselves with now today?
Oh, I offer no comfort. I'm sorry.
I know you write that, you know, kind of these negative histories never go out of style. So
yes. But it doesn't mean I'm pessimistic. I just think that, you know, our destiny is in our hands. And the main thing is to sort of keep our heads on. You know, but it is the kind of moment, I have to say, where, you know, this little bon mot of Kafka comes to mind. You know, Kafka had a friend who ended up being his biographer by the name of Max Brod, who loved Kafka but didn't really quite understand his writing. But one day Kafka reads a story to a group of friends, including to Max Brod, that's very depressing. And afterwards, his friend Max goes up to him and says, "Franz, it was just such a depressing story. Do you really think there's no hope?" And Kafka looks at him and says, "Hope? Of course there's hope. Infinite hope. Just not for us."
American political thinker, writer, and journalist Mark Lilla. The Shipwreck Mind on Political Reaction is published by the New York Review of Books and retails for in around €11 in paperback. I have to say, illuminating reading for anyone interested in how we got to where we are and the origins of populism. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the insightful words of Austrian modernist writer and thinker Robert Musil from his unfinished novel, The Man Without Qualities. A man cannot be angry at his own time without suffering some damage. Wise words indeed. Go easy and good night.